You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, we'll take a look at PFAS chemicals and their path from consumer products to water supplies. Now, the audience for women's basketball is booming after the NCAA tournament wrapped up yesterday. This year's championship game featured the Iowa Hawkeyes and National Player of the Year Caitlin Clark. They faced off against Louisiana State Tigers, led by Coach Kim Mulkey. In the end, LSU's balanced attack brought home the title.
Kim Mulkey, in year two, has orchestrated a turnaround for the ages. LSU has captured its very first national championship.
According to ESPN, viewership for the women's game is on the rise. This year's Final Four audience was up 66% over last season, and the semifinal game between Iowa and South Carolina got more viewers than any NBA game broadcast this year on ESPN. Sally Jenkins is a sports columnist for the Washington Post. She was the first woman to be inducted into the National Sportscasters and Sportswriters Hall of Fame, and she was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize in 2019. She's been covering the women's basketball tournament. Sally, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
I mentioned some of those audience numbers. We're seeing a big boost in viewership. It seems like a lot of excitement and momentum around the tournament. How would you describe this moment in women's basketball?
Well, it felt like a real crossroads for the game. People have been expecting some sort of breakthrough moment like this for a number of years, actually. The numbers have been growing steadily. But the 66% rise in viewership, a peak of 6 million viewers who watched Iowa and South Carolina in the semifinals, and 357,000 in paid in-person attendance. Those are really big numbers. That something really changed this week.
And the tournament had great games, big-name players. Now, what were some of the, storylines that you thought made this year so entertaining?
Well, the player of the year, Caitlin Clark, was certainly a huge factor, dropping 40 points, two consecutive tournament games, and then making it all the way to the championship game with the Iowa Hawkeyes. That was, I think, catnip for viewers. She's such a great offensive player, really extraordinary. She was being compared to Pete Maravich, really a crowd-pleasing offensive player. And then you had very popular teams with growing fan bases like South Carolina, where Dawn Staley, the Olympic gold medal winning head coach, has been building a really strong audience in South Carolina. And the same with Kim Mulkey, who's another Hall of Famer at Louisiana State, who, of course, won the whole thing. You're talking about women who've been working to really build deep fan bases for quite some years, and I think you're just seeing the payoff for that.
Now, looking back, I did some counting. For about 30 years, if you'd bet at the beginning of a season that either Tennessee or Connecticut was going to win it all, you'd have been right 19 out of 30 times. There's that dominance by a couple teams. Is part of the excitement here that we're seeing more and more teams, entering the picture and becoming competitive?
Well, I think there's something to that. UConn obviously always drew really, really large numbers, and so did Tennessee. I mean, the Pat Summitt teams and the Geno Auriemma teams with Diana Taurasi, certainly commanded very, very large numbers. But the consistency, the year in and year out, week in and week out, attendance and viewership throughout this tournament was really a significant change. And that's where I think that, yes, you do see the fact that UConn hasn't won the national championship since 2016 may have opened the door to, again, build some programs into prominence like South Carolina and Dawn Staley, Iowa and Caitlin Clark.
Now, for the popularity of a sport, it depends in some ways on how much the media covers it, but sometimes sports media will not want to cover a sport if they don't perceive it as possible. How have you seen that chicken or egg question playing out with ultimately more media exposure for women's college basketball?
Well, I can just give you one very direct example, which was I used to be the only person from my newspaper that would cover the women's Final Four. I would be there by myself. I usually requested to cover it. We would have sent somebody if I hadn't volunteered. But this time we had three people there. I was one of three from the Washington Post. We just have really, the Washington Post, the New York Times, USA Today, and ESPN, I think, and other national outlets have recognized that the audience, the readership was huge. I mean, yesterday, like every single story on our best read list was a women's basketball story. And we're talking on a Sunday when you have you also had some rather big events going on the men's side. So you had NBA games, you had the men's championship coming up. So it was really, really interesting to see.
when it comes to the day-to-day experience of student athletes, what do you think this jump in popularity could change?
Well, you know, one in three American girls now plays a varsity sport, is my understanding. It's gone from being something that, you know, very, very narrow. It was a marginal pursuit for young women when I was young. And it's become something that women simply, American women, you know, have made the shift from the ornamental to the active, if you will. I think there's just been a seismic change. You can see it culturally in everything from fashion to physique. These teams, along with the U.S. women's soccer team, which has been a really gigantic factor in terms of influencing young women's tastes and habits. I think all of these things have sort of been converging for several years now. But the women's basketball, this particular tournament, you had a sense that something that had been brewing for a long, long time really came to a head.
Are you seeing that enthusiasm at the college level translate into the professional game in the WNBA?
Well, that's right. And one, you know, I mean, another storyline here was the rivalry between Angel Reese of LSU and Caitlin Clark. And there was some, you know, a bit of taunting at the end of the game by Angel Reese. And there's obviously a very hot debate going on social media today. And so one of the, you know, interesting questions is, have women reached such a state of gender equity that trash talking, you know, has become mainstream in women's sports? So, it's an interesting phenomenon to see people debating women's basketball around the water cooler on a Monday, the way they used to really reserve that time only for men's sports.
All right. Well, the season is over now. You're catching your breath, I have assumed, from doing a lot of coverage. But what are you watching for in the next season now?
Well, I think Angel Reese and Caitlin Clark are both back for their schools. And also most of the players for Virginia Tech, which also made it to the Final Four, was a surprise factor in the Final Four. They're all returning. I think you can look for some personal rivalries. You'll see some reprises. You'll see, I think, a comeback by the University of Connecticut. They should be healthy next year and a factor again. And Dawn Staley is hunting her third national championship and was disappointed in the semifinal. And so South Carolina will have a chip on its shoulder. So I think you're going to have a really intense season next season. And what's interesting about that particularly is that the women's media rights are up for renegotiation. And what might have happened here with this tournament is it may have really jacked up the going rate to buy the television rights for NCAA women's basketball in 2024. I mean, we could have been looking at a $100 million tournament, that just completed. That could be the financial impact of having had such an exciting event that drew so many eyes at a time when a contract is expiring and up for new negotiations.
Sally, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure. Good to be with you.
That's Sally Jenkins, sports columnist at the Washington Post, member of the National Sportscasters and Sportswriters Hall of Fame. She joined us for a look at the record-setting audience numbers for this year's NCAA Women's Basketball Tournament. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a tribute to a beloved basketball coach.
The men's NCAA basketball tournament is wrapping up, and it caps a season in which Marquette University won a game in the tournament. And the occasion brings to mind the late Coach Al McGuire, whose Marquette basketball teams won 79% of their games. In 1977, in McGuire's final game as a coach, Marquette won the program's only national championship. McGuire's legacy transcends sports. The way he looked at the world, the way he expressed himself, made him a true original. Milwaukee journalist Tom Kircher, who authored a book on McGuire, reflects on the coach's magic with words.
As a sports fan growing up near Milwaukee, I admired Al McGuire's success in coaching basketball at Marquette University. Decades later, I did a book on Al McGuire because he was not your typical sports figure. Al was witty, acutely attentive to the world around him, and surprisingly sentimental. His words are worth remembering as March Madness winds down. First, Al's wit. Here are two of his bon mots. If the waitress has dirty ankles, the chili is good. The only mystery in life is why kamikaze pilots wore helmets. Yes, Al was a character. He once described how he took precautions to keep his players out of trouble in Milwaukee. We had someone from the FBI talk to us before the season, Al recalled. He told us there were three places in town we should declare off limits. I had been hanging out in two of them. Al was a bit of a street philosopher. Here's a quote of his that's fitting for Wisconsin. There's a nice feeling at 2 a.m. to see a beer sign. It's somewhere you can place a bet, or have an affair, or play a jukebox, or whatever. Of all the places I know on earth, it seems to be the most wholesome. You're not walking into anything that you have to prep yourself for. When you go in, you know what's there and what's expected of you. If you want to join in, you can. If you want to slip down to the end of the bar and cry in your beer, you can do that too. Perhaps my favorite quality of Al's was that he embraced his sensitive side. Like when he talked about what he expected of his team. I see either roses or weeds, Al said. It's definitely going to depend upon if the players really love each other or just make believe. It all gets down to love. If we have love, we'll be good. If we don't, we'll be bad. Al took time to reflect on life, like how that national championship affected him. You get compassion, he said. You lose the soot on your face. Let your hair grow. Put on your beach shoes. You lose your obnoxiousness, your surliness. The game isn't everything because you become more intelligent. You see more. Al McGuire passed away in 2001. He had some observations near the end, too. The doctors tell me that when I start to cough, it's pretty much over for me in 3 days. So I don't cough. There's this big, gray elephant in the room, and nobody wants to talk about it. But I know. But Al would go out with a smile. I'm moving towards the dancing lights, he said. Dancing lights and a soft landing.
Milwaukee journalist Tom Kircher brought us that story on former Marquette University basketball coach Al McGuire. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, we follow the trail of PFAS chemicals, from everyday consumer goods like toilet paper to the contamination found in our rivers, lakes, and fresh water supplies. That's next here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. A new study from the University of Florida finds that toilet paper should be considered a potential source of PFAS chemicals entering wastewater treatment systems. Researchers there looked at 21 major toilet paper brands from the U.S. and around the world. They found traces of these so-called forever chemicals in all of them. PFAS is a group of over 6,000 synthetic chemicals found in the consumer products we use every day. Anything that's nonstick, stain-resistant, grease-resistant, or waterproof might have PFAS chemicals in them. Plus, it's a big part of some firefighting technology. Even at low concentrations, some PFAS chemicals have been linked to negative health outcomes like thyroid disease, diabetes, and cancer. Our next guest has been researching PFAS contamination in Wisconsin and says most of the contamination in our state has been found in groundwater, our largest source of drinking water. Christy Remicall is an associate professor of civil and environmental engineering, director of the Water Science and Engineering Laboratory, and co-director of the Core Facility for Advanced Water Analysis at UW-Madison. Christy, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
We've got this study saying six different PFAS compounds in toilet paper. The American Forest and Paper Association says we're not adding these to toilet paper. What do you think of yet another product on the list of potential sources of PFAS chemicals?
Well, I mean, you're right. I feel like we hear about new places that have PFAS every day. PFAS have been found in other paper products as well. So on one hand, it's not a surprise. It's a little unclear why they're in toilet paper. But we also know that there is plenty of PFAS that makes its way to wastewater treatment plants. And so it does make sense that they're there.
Now, you've been following this story in Wisconsin for some time now. What, as far as we know right now, what are the main sources of these PFAS chemicals in our water here in Wisconsin?
Well, when we look here in Wisconsin specifically, as you said in the intro, a lot of our contamination is found in groundwater, which is our really highly important water resource in the state. In many cases, contamination is associated with the use of PFAS-containing firefighting foams. And so we often find high concentrations near airports or military installations. There are other sources as well, but those are some of the big ones that we think about.
Now, the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, last month proposed limiting levels in drinking water to pretty low levels that tests are able to detect. That would put a lot of communities here in Wisconsin at higher than recommended levels. What are you looking at when you look at standards to say, okay, this much is safe, this much isn't?
Right. Well, it's great that the EPA is finally putting out proposed standards. It's long overdue that we have federal regulations for these chemicals because we know they're toxic at low concentrations. The concentrations they proposed as standards were quite a bit higher than the health advisories, and they were trying to balance, you know, having utilities be able to meet these requirements with protecting human health. And so, like I said, they're long overdue that we have standards being proposed.
What do you see as the best way to try to keep PFAS out of our water in the future? What would be your number one strategy?
Well, exactly what you said is keeping, the most important thing we can do is keeping these chemicals from getting in the environment in the first place. So decreasing their use in firefighting foams is a good example, but also decreasing their use in consumer products, things that we use every day. So people can choose to pick products that don't have PFAS. Anything we can do to prevent these chemicals from getting in the environment in the first place is important because they're so persistent and mobile. They last such a long time. So it's really, prevention is the key approach here.
They're in so many products, presumably because they are useful in making things nonstick mm-hmm. or making effective firefighting foams. Is there a thought that these are replaceable for the things we want, or at least if not, that the benefits of getting rid of them outweigh the cost of not using them?
You're absolutely right. They are really, you know, these chemicals have a lot of great applications, and so they're in things that we love. You know, think about your Teflon pan at home. It's nice to not have to scrub to clean off your pan. However, there are definitely alternatives. You know, we use cast iron and things like that at my house. There are different things you can use. Lots of different products coming out there as, you know, companies are starting to make more products that don't have PFAS because of increased attention to them. And so there are alternatives we can choose for many cases.
If we were today somehow to stop all PFAS use, how long would it take to deal with the chemicals that are already in our groundwater and other water systems?
Oh, goodness, you're right. I mean, we do have quite a legacy of contamination to deal with. You know, some of the chemicals that we're measuring and finding in our water were put there decades ago. And, you know, as you mentioned, we're really concerned about very low concentrations in our water. And so we have quite a bit of work to do to clean up the mess that already exists.
Now, we've got communities like Wausau trying to treat all the water for PFAS, seeing some financial shortfalls. Eau Claire planning to build a filtration addition to its water treatment plant. A lot of communities. What goes into filtering PFAS out of water supplies?
Yeah, and what we're doing now with a lot of the water treatment applications is filtering the PFAS out, and then you have this contaminated filter that you have to deal with at the end. We don't yet have a good large-scale destructive technology for these chemicals. This is something that's happening at the research stage right now. But you can basically think about many of these filters, they use activated carbon. That's the most common one. It's kind of like a really big Brita filter, and that's what's removing the PFAS from municipal water treatment supplies. And you're right, they can be quite costly, especially for small utilities.
A key here is, you know, some pollutants, they're going to break down on their own over time. People call PFAS forever chemicals. Really, these, they just don't break down, at least on a human timeline?
There are, you know, so the ones that we worry about, like PFOS and PFOA, do not have any known natural degradation processes that we know about right now. They do last a very long time. Some PFAS do degrade, and they transform into the ones that don't degrade. And so, you know, like PFOA is a really good example. They last a very long time, and that's why they're called forever chemicals.
We're obviously concerned about drinking water here in the state. How about Great Lakes and water finding its way in there? Is this becoming a substantial problem, potentially an environmental risk there?
PFAS have been measured in every environment on the planet. Of course, they're found in the Great Lakes. The concentrations tend to increase as you move from like the Western Lakes, like Superior is relatively low compared to Erie and Ontario, where concentrations are higher. And you worry about concentrations in fish in some of these lakes. PFAS have really been found around the planet. You know, even in the Arctic, places far away from people, you find PFAS really everywhere. It's really a global issue.
And your work, just in our last few moments, involves PFAS in rivers and streams that go into Green Bay and the Great Lakes. Briefly, what is a big question you're still tackling?
Yeah, so we're looking at where these chemicals are coming from. So in rivers, as well as groundwater that's coming into the lake, we're looking at sources of these chemicals and really how these chemicals move in the environment. And the idea is to not, you know, if you can understand where they're coming from, prevent pollution. And then if you know kind of where they're ending up, thinking about how to inform remediation efforts in the future.
Christy, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks.
Christy Remekal is an associate professor of civil and environmental engineering, director of the Water Science and Engineering Laboratory, and co-director of the Core Facility for Advanced Water Analysis at UW-Madison. She joined us today with a look at how PFAS chemicals are contaminating our water supply and what we can do to prevent it in the future. This is a story in your community. Love to hear about it. Maybe it's something we could tackle in a future show or pass on to our news team for that matter. Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, the U.S. Senate voted to end the use of force authorization originally granted for the Iraq War 20 years ago. We'll look at the decision and how that authorization has been used over the years. Plus, a legendary adventure returns to the big screen with turtles and mushrooms. We'll look at the pop culture role of Mario. That's tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we've got your number, 100 of them, actually. We'll talk to the co-author of a new book, Settling 100 Debates About Which Athlete Throughout History Gets to Own Their Number. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, political divides in Wisconsin leave a lot of people feeling discouraged about civic participation. A UW-Madison researcher joins us with a new report on what's driving us apart and how we can strengthen democracy in the state. First, pick a number, 1 to 100. Got it? Chances are good there's a healthy, maybe even heated sports debate around who owns that particular number. Owns, like, for example, the number 12. Lots of players have worn it. Lots of big-name football quarterbacks. It's one way to choose who you're comparing. Which one was best while wearing it? Who gets to be at the top of the 12s? Debates like these rise and fall in stadium seats, dinner tables, bars, and social media threads. And our next guest was part of a team that settled 100 of those debates. Forever. Or at least for a couple minutes. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Is there a number? When you think of that, you think of that particular player in sports at whatever level, global, across the country, or here in Wisconsin. Is this a question you've ever debated with friends or family members? Is there a current Wisconsin player who might own a particular number in the future? And why is it Giannis Antetokounmpo? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Paul Hemikidis, also known as Hembo, is a content producer for ESPN's Get Up. He partners with Mike Greenberg on ESPN Radio's Greeny. They're co-authors of the new book, Got Your Number, The Greatest Sports Legends and the Numbers They Own. Hembo, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, the pleasure's all mine. This has been as much fun to talk about as we could have possibly imagined. When you write a book, you obviously put it on ice for quite some time. And over the last couple of weeks, as we've been doing things like these, it's just been such a delight to see the amount of interest and opinion that this idea has generated. So it is a delight to talk with you today. And I'm hoping that you and I will find some common ground with these numbers and maybe even some disagreements along the way, too. That's part of the fun.
It definitely. And that's one of my takeaways from this book is, of course, these are highly subjective and highly personal things. But the choices you've made are great conversation starters. Was that part of the goal from the outset?
Yes, that is most definitely part of the goal. So I would describe the book as having sort of two pillars, if you will. The first is what you just described. sports debate. Numbers are obviously the vernacular of every sports fan. Whether you are a casual fan, whether you are a passionate fan, you are at least to some degree fluent in numbers. And that has been something that has become exceedingly clear as we have kind of unveiled this idea and talked to fans and readers across the country. But the second half of it is sports history. And that is really what I major in as someone who sort of made his bones at ESPN first and foremost as a researcher. That's really what I took a lot of pride in when it comes to this project. Obviously, a lot of these decisions were excruciating. But once we made them, it was my responsibility to drum up the very, very best numbers that money could buy to justify each and every one of our selections. So like I said, you might disagree, and justifiably so, on some of the decisions that we made. But my hope and my expectation is that when you do get a chance to read our book, Got Your Number, at minimum, we can make a defensible case why we chose each of the people in most cases that we chose. And that's the very best that we can do.
And the criteria, you know, you might be comparing a NFL quarterback against a Major League Baseball shortstop. Obviously, you can't take numbers and compare them. Can you talk about some of the things that went into this? Some of it's the statistics, some of it's the significance. And as you mentioned, the place in sports history.
Yeah, so much of it is the legend of the player. So I'll just throw out a number, for example, and show you some of the excruciating decisions that we struggle through. So especially comparing players across sports, how do you do it? So for example, number 21, worn by Roberto Clemente, worn by Tim Duncan, worn by Deion Sanders, worn by LaDainian Tomlinson. I mean, truly, it's a fool's errand to try and scientifically, objectively, discern who is the person that owns that number, right? So what you have to then do is use other criterion. I think in this case, the way that I would describe these players, just again, as an example, Roberto Clemente is probably the greatest legend that ever wore number 21. Tim Duncan is probably the most accomplished. Deion Sanders is, I think, beyond most question, the greatest player at his position ever. And by that measure, probably the cornerback by whom all other corners that have since come have been compared and probably will until the end of time. So you're forced to make excruciating decisions based upon as much science as you can. But ultimately, there's as much an art to this as there is a science. And in some cases, the longer, like the older a player you were, the longer your legend has endured wound up being a tiebreaker for us in many cases. So we really canvass more than a century of sports history in so doing.
Talking to Paul Hembakidis, talking about a new book he co-wrote. It's called Got Your Number, The Greatest Sports Legends and the Numbers They Own. You could join in at 800-642-1234. I know this is public radio, and sometimes you're a little shy about admitting that you're a sports fan. I know you're out there. Call in with your favorite sports player, the most important, the one you'd say, yeah, they own that number on their jersey. They're the greatest in that jersey of all time. Call in with your questions for our guest about how they made these choices, who got chosen, and were you lucky enough to see some of the legends who at least might be in the running play? Maybe Hank Aaron. We'll start naming names in a minute. Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, other great Wisconsin legends. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Paul, I want to start naming names, and I want to start with the greatest player to ever play for the Eau Claire Bears, plus the Milwaukee Brewers and Atlanta Braves, Hank Aaron, number 44. And I think there's a really solid case that he should own number 44. Talk about that.
I think we could be playing sports for another 1,000 years, and Henry Aaron would still be the person that you would say owns the number 44. It is still, candidly, a crowded field. Willie McCovey and Reggie Jackson both wore number 44 from the game of baseball. Jerry West wore number 44 in his NBA career and his college career. Pete Maravich wore the number 44. Jim Brown wore the number 44 in college. I created lists like this for literally every single number, 1 through 100, you might imagine, because it was important to me, important to us, to canvass the world of sports to not assume that we could possibly forget or miss anybody. But in the case of Henry Aaron, I mean, obviously, there are two numbers for which you strongly associate him. It's 44 and it's 755. I guess, you know, he had to get to 715 before he got to 755. That would have been a much longer book. So in the absence of being able to go past the number 100, it was clear to me that 44 was where he belonged. You can make a very credible argument that Henry Aaron is, if not the most accomplished hitter that ever lived, perhaps the most productive hitter that ever lived. It is very likely that you talk to sports fans 100 years from now, and they will still consider him, and not Barry Bonds, the all-time record holder. I think 755 is a much more enduring number than 762 because of that. Parenthetically, the number of total bases that Henry Aaron accumulated throughout his career, there is a chasm between he and Albert Pujols, who ranks second on that list. I'm talking about seasons that Albert Pujols would still need to play at a high level in order to catch him. I mean, truthfully, Henry Aaron is in the very last sentence of greatest baseball player that ever lived. You could not possibly write a book like this without including Henry Aaron. When we were going through our list, 1 through 100, that was one of those numbers. Even though there's some other great athletes to wear 44, that we moved lickety-split. It was Henry Aaron. His name was mentioned, and we moved on to number 45. That's how convinced we were that Henry Aaron owned the number 44.
You share some of the history in the book, too, and I knew about the death threats that came to him as he was pursuing Babe Ruth's championship as a black player. People weren't happy about this. One anecdote you share is about what looked like a hug from Hank Aaron's mom after he broke that record. The true story behind that?
Yes. She later admitted, I guess somewhat begrudgingly, that she was doing that in part to shield her son from the snipers. I mean, we are living at a time in which Henry Aaron is now considered baseball royalty. But the fact of the matter is, Henry Aaron encountered enormous obstacle and prejudice along the way. I mean, Bowie Kuhn, the commissioner of Major League Baseball, was not even in attendance. Henry Aaron's belief many years later was that Braves fans were somewhat reluctant to credit him with passing Babe Ruth. And fans around the country, in some cases, were fighting against him. He famously kept a lot of that hate mail. And amidst that torrent of hatred and bigotry, he stood above it all. He rose above it all. My favorite quote, I think, that Henry Aaron ever said in relation to that home run chase, despite all of that, is, "I don't want them to forget Babe Ruth. I just want them to remember me." Think about that and the kind of person you have to be for that to be your high-level takeaway after enduring all that he did.
Talking to Paul Hemikidis, content producer for ESPN's Get Up, co-author of the new book, Got Your Number, The Greatest Sports Legends and the Numbers They Own. You can join in with your opinions, your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Is there a Wisconsin athlete who's on your greatest of all time list? We'll see if they were in contention to make it in this book of numbers. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Hembo Hemikidis with ESPN's Get Up and Greeny programs. He's co-author of the new book, Got Your Number, The Greatest Sports Legends and the Numbers They Own. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Who to you is the biggest legend in your sport of choice? The greatest achievement in sports history in Wisconsin and beyond? You can join in at 800-642-1234. If there's a number you associate with a star athlete, tell us about it. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Let's bring on a caller. Patrick is with us in Wausau. Patrick, hi.
Good afternoon.
What do you want to bring up, Patrick?
I'd like to know who owns number 15. I think it should be Bart Starr.
It's a strong case, Patrick, to be made for Bart Starr. I think I got bad news for you, Hembo, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, we determined that Bart Starr does not own the number 15, though there is no question that a great case could be made and should be made in some cases for Bart Starr. Number 15 is challenging. So in the current game today, you have Patrick Mahomes, who I think one could reasonably argue is already on a Hall of Fame track, and is a player for whom 10 or 15 years from now, we might consider him one of the very greatest of all time. Obviously, Bart Starr's legend and career is etched in stone, playing quarterback for the Green Bay Packers, and is a legendary figure in the sports history. What we also wanted to do, however, in creating this book was sort of make a composite of all sports, and which in that case, that includes things that are beyond just jersey numbers. It includes jersey numbers that are beyond just the four major sports. So as you might expect, you will find plenty of professional football and basketball and baseball and hockey players. What you should also know is that only 56 out of the 100 chapters are assigned jersey numbers, which is to say, you'll find cases in which we've assigned a number to a record or to a year. So in other words, this has a little bit more diversity than maybe I've led on to believe. However, zooming out, what I would like to say is that it is our belief that Tim Tebow might well be the greatest college quarterback that ever lived. There are not many college football players in our book, but it is our belief that Tim Tebow and his legend at the University of Florida and winning multiple championships and winning the Heisman as an underclassman and then becoming a finalist on other occasions had a career in college, the gravity of which exceeded that of Bart Starrs in the NFL. Now, I'm on Wisconsin public radio right now. And so there is a really, really good chance that if you are within the sound of my voice, you strongly disagree with that. And you are allowed to disagree with that. However, it was our belief that Tim Tebow owns the number 15 based upon his legendary college career. And while Bart Starr makes an excellent case, and while Bart Starr was absolutely among our finalists and potentially even a runner-up, what we could not possibly do was make everyone happy. That's part of the fun. There are only 100 chapters. And so ultimately, as unsatisfying as it is to say on Wisconsin public radio, Tim Tebow for us owns the number 15.
Patrick, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Another one of those numbers I wanted to bring up that isn't a jersey number, Babe Didrikson at number 46, Olympic track and field athlete, golfer, like just all athletics all the time. Inspirational to a number of girls growing up in athletics, including a daughter of mine, an athlete who wrote one of her big school reports on Babe Didrikson. Can you talk about her and her ownership of the number 46?
Absolutely. So again, I want to double back on one of the attributes of this book that I'm so proud of, and that is the inclusion of sports from a wide range, the inclusion of female athletes, for which you could not credibly do this book without. And it is my belief that Babe Didrikson might well be the greatest female athlete of all time, at least in the history of our country. If you're not familiar with her backstory, it's a fascinating one. But she ranked 10th. She ranked number 10 in Sports Century's retrospective, I guess now 23 years ago. And so even if you were to take into account some of the female athletes that have since come to pass, she is at the very, very top of that list. We assigned Babe Didrikson number 46. So she was an incredible Olympian. 1932 was her greatest year as an Olympian, but 1946 was her greatest year as a golfer. She was a legendary golfer, and it was exceedingly important for us to include her in addition to a number of other female athletes. And so ultimately, based upon her extraordinary resume and reputation, both as an Olympian, as a star in that world, and also then later in the world of golf, I mean, dominating multiple sports for a long period of time, she was a shoe-in for the book. The challenge was to find a good number for her because, of course, she did not compete in a team sport, at least not directly. And thus, we assigned 46 to her based upon her exploits in the year of 1946.
Talking to Hembo Hemakidis, the new book is Got Your Number, The Greatest Sports Legends and the Numbers They Own. You can join in if there's a number you attach to a particular athlete, a jersey number or achievement number at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Paul, a very personal one for me. I grew up in the Detroit radio market. And the legend is I was named Rob after the guy from the Dick Van Dyke Show. Choice number two was Gordy. After Gordie Howe, Detroit Red Wings legend, was this an easy choice for you at number nine?
Yes, I think his body of work is I think almost incomparable when you consider how beloved Gordie Howe is both in that city and in the game of in the sport of hockey, but also the longevity with which he played. I mean, there are numbers that are in this book that I could not believe, and I'm someone who majors in this stuff every single day. That being said, while we did land on Gordie Howe at number nine, Greeny and I did a book signing yesterday for which someone had a very credible question and asked, how did you justify Gordie Howe over Ted Williams, the splendid splinter, a person who walks down the street and you say, there goes the greatest hitter that ever lived. First of all, no one in the world, I don't know a single person who's a bigger baseball fan than I am. Baseball is well represented in our book, and that I can assure you. But even so, it is my belief that Gordie Howe's legend and stature within his sport, frankly, is greater than Ted Williams and his stature within his. That was one for which it was obviously excruciating to choose. But in the end, Greeny and I did come to consensus. It is Gordie Howe and not Ted Williams that owns the number nine.
Back to our callers. Mitch is with us in West Allis. Mitch, hi.
Hi. I would like to nominate Dale Earnhardt, the Intimidator, for number three.
Mitch, thanks a lot for the call. Now, NASCAR is represented. You had Richard Petty, I think, and Jimmy Johnson, very justifiably. Dale Earnhardt, I didn't think intimidated his way into number three, though.
No. And that is because if this book had one chapter, it would be Babe Ruth at number three. I mean, who are we kidding? If you were to do a book here, a sports book, for which you were assigning who owns every number 1 through 100, you could not, in my judgment, you could not make a credible case that anyone could be number three except for Babe Ruth. It just cannot be done. Babe Ruth, I think, is on the very short list, along with Muhammad Ali and Tiger Woods and Michael Jordan, as the greatest athletes that our nation has ever produced. His cultural significance was enormous. His significance on the game of baseball, and it becoming something recognizable like what it is now. Like, without Babe Ruth, baseball might well have looked very different for the last 100 years. Babe Ruth retired, and the records that he set, especially in the power department, some of which have not been touched, and most of which were not touched for decades. Babe Ruth essentially rewrote baseball's record book and holds an enormous place in the American sporting landscape. There are two drivers in the book. Richard Petty owns number 43. Spoiler alert. Jimmy Johnson owns the number 48. Spoiler alert. But ultimately, this is about the numbers. And in my judgment, you cannot make a credible case for Dale Earnhardt over the Bambino.
Mitch, thanks a lot for that call. I want to look toward the future. Here in Wisconsin, we got Giannis Antetokounmpo. In the future, he might own number 34. I know, he's still playing. He's got a while to go. To get it, he has to beat out Walter Payton. What do you think about that debate of the future, Hembo?
So this was a challenge for us. One thing our book is fairly light on is current active athletes. And that's because, well, so much of these things are decided through the anthology of history, right? And so I think there is a very credible case to be made that by the time Giannis retires, he will be the number 34 in all of sports. But right now, that is a list that includes Walter Payton and Charles Barkley and Hakeem Olajuwon and David Ortiz. Might Giannis someday occupy that top spot? Absolutely. But the bottom line of it is he chose a number that is absolutely stacked and loaded, and he's still only 28 years old. One thing for which we were not comfortable doing, hence our Patrick Mahomes decision, was projecting. We were not comfortable making assumptions about what a player might become. That sort of defeats the purpose of the exercise. The ownership of a number is something that does take time to develop and then crystallize. And in this case, with Walter Payton running his entire career in Chicago wearing the number 34, as you guys all unfortunately know, it was very difficult for us to make a case for Giannis or frankly anyone else aside from Sweetness.
I want to go to number one now. It was Ozzie Smith, legendary shortstop. You know, there's these rule changes in baseball now. I hear the name Ozzie Smith, the This Week in Baseball theme song from the 80s pops into my head when they had the montage of amazing defensive plays. That one, I love that choice because it's like a game of a different time that maybe with these new rules is going to come back, or we're going to see players making plays like that again with the ball in play more.
Baseball is now going to return to a time in which being athletic mattered way more than it did even 1 year ago. Baseball is going to now reward players with a wide variance of skill set. Baseball is no longer going to be a sport for which a game will be decided via home run derby. Now, I don't think baseball is going to be, say, totally unrecognizable. Although I suppose if you drop someone in today and you begun watching with a pitch clock, you might say to yourself, well, this is pretty unrecognizable. But a player like Ozzie Smith last year would not have been so valuable. This year would likely be eminently valuable because the ease with which you can steal bases now and the abolition of the shift has put a premium on middle infield defense. Well, who could do those things better than Ozzie Smith? He is inarguably the greatest infielder of all time. And by the way, he stole 580 bases. In our opinion, Ozzie Smith is a great way to kick off the book. He is on the very short list of the greatest shortstops of all time, obviously. And the Wizard of Oz and players like that didn't really have a place in baseball over the last 15, 20, 25 years. In all candor, my earnest hope, as someone who very much, as you can tell, enjoys the history of baseball, is that those kinds of players enjoy a renaissance with the rule changes.
Well, we can agree on that. And Hembo, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, bud.
That's Paul Hembo Hembakidis, content producer for ESPN, partner of Mike Greenberg on ESPN Radio's Greeny. We talked to him about a new book he's co-authored with Greenberg called Got Your Number, The Greatest Sports Legends and the Numbers They Own. Coming up after the news, we'll hear the results of the new Civic Fracture and Renewal Survey from UW-Madison that aims to identify our biggest political divides and some ideas on how to repair them. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.